Welcome to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. I'm your host, Evan Epstein. In this episode, I talk with Kate Mitchell, a co-founder of Scale Venture Partners, a Silicon Valley-based venture capital firm that invests in early-stage tech companies. Kate is a past chair and board member of the National Venture Capital Association and is active in policy matters that impact entrepreneurship, startups, innovation, and inclusion. She co-authored the IPO section of the 2012 Jobs Act and is currently working on additional legislation to help small company IPOs. More importantly for this podcast, Kate is a very experienced investor and board member in public, private, and nonprofit boards. She currently serves on the boards of SVB Financial Group, Fortiv Corporation, and the Silicon Valley Community Foundation. If you like this show, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast with colleagues or friends. If you'd like to reach out to me, you can find me on LinkedIn or Twitter at Evan Epstein. You can also check out all the details related to this podcast, including show notes and reference materials at www.boardroom-governance.com. Hi, Kate. Thank you very much for taking the time for this podcast. It's great to have you. How's life for you these days?
Well, I am. We are recording this during COVID time, so it's good. And I am very happy to connect with others, at least virtually. So there we go. That's
great. Okay, so first, we're going to go through your origin story. And what I want to know is, you know, back in your professional and maybe academic background, how did you get to be a venture capitalist?
Well, that's a long and tortuous, perhaps, journey. There is not always a direct line. And certainly when I was getting in the industry 20 plus years ago, not a direct line from, you know, venture capitalist when I was at Stanford, class of 1980, which dates me. But that wasn't a job that people talked about. I mean, it was really a nascent industry. So I think certainly for my peer group, it is, you ended up getting to it. And I think more commonly now, even for people that are joining it, through some aspect of industry that gives you two things. One, the ability to understand, underwrite, and find good deals. In our case, I had done enterprise. I'd been using and developing and launching enterprise software solutions the first half of my career. So I could understand what we do at Scale Venture Partners, which is invest in enterprise software, because I'd been buying it for quite some time. Secondly, you end up with something that entrepreneurs value, in that I had managed up to 700 people. I had launched, I was with Bank of America at the time, launching the first bank on the internet. This crazy guy named Craig Newmark was consulting for me because he was not as an employee, because he was launching something called Craigslist. Mm-hmm. Mark Andreessen of Netscape, when they were still private, this is in the early 90s, helped us launch our online banking on top of the commerce on top of our ATM, and use some technology to help us solve, you know, and get to the internet. We partnered with Steve Case at AOL. We weren't sure if people would like the Wild West, we thought, of the internet. Would they prefer being in a walled garden like AOL? So it was the Wild West at the time, and a really interesting time to think about innovating, and particularly around something, as you know, that had been around for such a long time, like banking. So, you know, like other venture capitalists at that point, then moving into venture, having something to offer to an entrepreneur that was going to be taking technology into various other markets. It was definitely an interesting time, both to be in tech as a practitioner, and then you know, in the late 90s, which I have been now through two cycles, the 2000 dot-com bubble and mm-hmm. the 2008 bubble, and we're in something in COVID time now,
right?
And so that's part of it too. It's a cyclical business. Having that experience is pretty helpful. So I consider myself pretty fortunate in my journey.
No, definitely. And one of the things that makes you really interesting for this podcast is you have a very broad experience in boards, both in venture-backed boards, in public boards, and even in nonprofit boards. So basically, you've seen it all. And it's really interesting to talk about these different issues. Maybe we should start with some of your thoughts on venture-backed boards versus public boards, and we'll dig into kind of these spaces more. But let's start with this very broad question. You know, what do you think are the major distinctions between serving in a venture-backed board and a publicly traded board?
By the way, I'll pivot a little bit from your last comment about I have been sitting on boards, and I lost count. I know I have done 24 CEO searches for private, been with entities and been on CEO search teams 24 times, public, mainly private, some public and some nonprofit boards. But I should count the number of boards I've been on. But obviously, I've done that many CEO replacements. It's well over 20. Interestingly enough, my very first board was a nonprofit board. Mm-hmm. And I now, at this stage of my career, I'm rejoining them. What I learned about that, and for listeners of this podcast, I did it early in my career as a way to learn from the, to get a different perspective on any job I was doing and to meet people with different skill sets and to think about board governance. It was a shelter for abused children at the time called Children's Garden. And I now am on Silicon Valley Community Foundation and Meals on Wheels board. But when I was interviewing for my very first nonprofit position, and I think this is a rule for people that are sitting on privates and certainly public boards, I ask this with people I interview for board positions, I'm always loved to hear, and when I first went out for my first nonprofit board, it was all this stuff, great stuff I was going to do to help this nonprofit. I hear the same thing from people wanting to join private and public boards. Mm-hmm. I was counseled in my first board search, and I've kept it with me ever since. Don't only think about it in terms of what you can give, and you certainly should be thinking about that. Mm-hmm. That should be number one. But number two is what you're getting back. And the counsel I got, this was for a woman, Susan Hoganson, who'd done a whole lot of nonprofit work, a real leader in that regard. Her comment to me was, if you know what you're getting out of it and what at the time you're trying to learn in the early board I was sitting on, it was all about understanding even how to behave with other senior people in a board and what a board does. And now I think about it as what can I give to this board, public, private, nonprofit, and what can I learn back? And mm-hmm. that engagement, that tie, that sense of what can I give, and in like measure, what am I learning? I think it's a great growth mindset for anybody to have who's thinking about board seats. So long story short about boards, and by the way, I think caveat for your listeners, unlike many of your other presenters so far, mm-hmm. based on your podcast, mm-hmm. I'm not a lawyer. So if I touch on the law, do know that I am not practicing without a law degree. I formally am not practicing law. Yes. We will rely, Evan, on you to provide any insight or correction.
No problem. In fact, we do encourage non-lawyers to be in this podcast to have the broader vision of boards. And, that's one thing that was interesting from the Rock Center is that we were a center both from the law school and business school. And it's very interesting that people have a view of what a board should be from a legal perspective and of an organizational perspective. And so business people and legal practitioners have different views of the board. And it's really interesting to have these different visions because it's a different answer if you ask a lawyer or if you ask a business person what they do. And it's really interesting to make it contrast of those. So do not worry. We encourage your vision, and that's not a problem for this podcast.
Good. So your question to me was thinking about the distinction between private and public boards. And it's a great question. It's one I've been asked before by particularly as I joined public boards in the last decade. And I'll give you kind of the top line thoughts for me and love any questions that you have that you think your listeners might be interested in. First, I should talk about on a private board, what I was doing on the board. And the private boards I invested in them as a venture capitalist. Let's stop for a second and think about what that means. Because when you think of a public board, you've got a lot of independent directors and management. This is a very mm-hmm. different construct. Mm-hmm. What I think of myself as a venture capitalist, my mother is a former nurse and she's got a pension from the nursing union. And that nursing union needs returns, just like sovereign wealth funds and endowments and foundations, corporate, private, public pensions. My job is to be the conduit between my mother's need for return to support her retirement and the best entrepreneur that will provide the growth for her. I charge more as an investment vehicle than, let's say, a other kinds of mutual funds or you know, index funds as an example. For that, I have to help those public, private pensions, all the different limited partners who I have a fiduciary responsibility to. My job is to find the best entrepreneurs, guide and help those entrepreneurs who are the heroes of what we do. I provide pattern recognition. I've done it before. I've built companies. I've gone through the stages of growth. My job is to find the best company, help them be successful. Again, the entrepreneurs are the heroes, and then provide multiples of return. We are the high risk, high return portion of those institutional investors' portfolios. So I ended up, therefore, sitting on private boards because I invested in the companies. So that's number one. And we'll talk about that as I go through this difference, because that plays a pretty big role of what brought me to that. So if you think about, you know, there was a great Egyptian entrepreneur who had been one of the first engineers at Oracle, who is now an investor himself, Samir Shalabi, who I really enjoyed. And I remember we were very early stage investor and we're sitting across the table. I just wrote a check and Samir's the entrepreneur. And it's the two of us. It's like the conversation we're having today. And at the time, you know, right out of the box, that was the board. And so a board can be so much smaller than we see in the movies, a large board with a big board table. This is pretty informal. I'm stepping over boxes to get to the board table. And we are solving the problems of the company, which at that time is getting a product out, hiring people, the really basic kinds of things. And one of the things you find in this conversation with Samir, and you find often in seed conversations, again, as I point out, you know, management's role is clear and very consistent from very small startups all the way through, you know, a public company. It's to guide the growth of their company, to have enough capital to get their job done, all those kinds of things. I am different than most public investors and different than my current positions are in public boards, in that I've got two hats on, in that I'm a board member. And as a board member of a startup, I do have a fiduciary responsibility to all shareholders, and that includes the management team. So and it includes all the other private investors, perhaps small angel investors and others who may not be in that boardroom, all the employees that are out there coding away to get a product out. And as a board member, I represent all those shareholders. On the other hand, I earned that board seat as a representative of scale and therefore indirectly our limited partners. Those can be two very different things. Sure. There are times when the best thing for me is to let's sell the company, perhaps let's go forward. And the entrepreneur is saying, no, I want to raise another round. Okay, we have a little conflict here. How much do I pay you in bonus versus keep to build and grow the company? All these kinds of things. Early on, one of the things that scale venture partners, we therefore always require is an independent director. We think that is the healthiest thing. And I remember sitting across that table with Samir and us having the conversation about, we need to have a third party here. It will be a translator back and forth. They will bring a leavening, a balance, and help draw the line for all of us about when my role is distinct between I'm speaking as an investor and what's good for scale, which may or may not be what's good for all investors. So I'm a big fan of independent directors from the earliest days. And by the way, as an early day, an investor who joins a startup board is probably somebody who's helping figure out how to develop or sell the company, another independent coach for the company. But that independence is also extremely important. So that's kind of one distinction. We have these people with kind of funny hats. It's not as common in the big public companies we all think of to have, you know, and certainly with activists and others, we now do have people with board seats, but it's not as common. That's not what we think of. The second thing that's different is their future rounds. There's a lot of fundraising. And, you know, between what we think of as an exit and a real liquidity event, meaning at the point at which we're either selling the company to a larger public company or liquid shares, is 8 to 12 years. We get to know each other very well. I went to Samir's wedding. I followed, you know, you get to know, you have friends and have children over the course of your investment. So it's a much longer horizon that we have in terms of, we certainly measure success from each one of the subsequent rounds that we're putting into usually what is a loss-making company. But our horizon is very long-term. We're thinking about what we can be maybe for the next round, which would be 2 years out, but we're really, our target is 10 to 12 years out. So it's a very different mindset than quarterly earnings. It's a very different mindset. The other thing, and this came to me when I joined the board of Silicon Valley Bank a decade ago, and I a couple of years after that started chairing the comp committee, and I remember meeting with their management team and the head of HR, and one of the leaders on the HR team asked me the same question you just asked me, the difference between a public and private board, and at that point, really enjoying being on that board, and I stopped and said, you know, the big difference is that in a private board, all the constituents are around the table or right outside the door coding. So if we decide to sell the company, invest aggressively and start losing more money, we have the votes right there. We can raise our hands, open the door maybe to the boardroom and game over. And what's interesting in a public company is myself and the leadership team, you know, ourselves as board members and the leadership team, we're dealing with this amorphous third party, the investor, who we don't even know. By name, we haven't seen. And it's a very different constituent, you know, mindset and how you are thinking about this third party. We talk about compensation. We think about what is fair for that invisible third party, the investor, those public investors. So it's a very different mindset. And you have to be much more mindful and, of course, think about communication and other things. The thing that is different when you go back to, you know, Samir and I sitting around a small conference table with, you know, boxes and, you know, bring your own lunch kind of idea that is consistent is, as I mentioned, you know, I represent large institutions for whom I have a fiduciary responsibility, which extends into my portfolio companies. We care about audits. We care about the quality of the IP. We care about managing liability. So we do have, even though it's two of us and soon it became three and then, of course, got much larger over time, we have similar, even though it looks very different, the board deals with audit, comp, liabilities, IP. They deal with everything rather than having committees that you typically see in a bigger governance structure. It's very common. It's one of the reasons that the acquirers are now sitting on the boards of public companies like Fortive, which is a serial acquirer, as is Silicon Valley Bank. It is much easier. There is less risk to solve for when you're looking to acquire a private equity or venture-backed startup because that fiduciary question, are they going to have they paid taxes? Can they wrap that they have done all the right things? I don't have to discount for uncertainty. I can have uncertainty about the underlying nature of what it is I'm acquiring, but I don't have to discount for the uncertainty of governance. So there's, you know, that governance structure is still exists.
That's great. So one of the questions that I think is happening in Silicon Valley that you may respond is you mentioned you had a 10-12 year horizon typically when you were investing in these companies. And what we've seen is that 10-12 year horizon, which is based on your fund duration, is now getting extended, right? And many companies are staying private for beyond that fund duration. And that is impacting kind of liquidity. So maybe, you know, tell us how the liquidity in startups has evolved. And there are all these secondary markets and different third-party tender offers, share buybacks, direct listings. How have you seen this evolution? Because it really is only 5 years old or maybe 10 years old. And in your time frame in being in boards, maybe this has changed. And maybe you can tell us more about that part.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting. You know, I, again, having been in the industry now for the venture side for over 20 years, one of the things that's very different about this or exacerbated in this end, the high risk, high reward end of the investing continuum and board continuum and governance continuum, is it's highly cyclical. So you think about the cycles in the public market, the highs are higher in the private market and the lows are lower. And we do find this balance between times when investors have a lot of power because capital is scarce and time when entrepreneurs have a lot of power and a lot of alternatives because capital is prevalent. And the last 10 years, we have been in a situation where that has been the case. I think there are also some non-cyclical, I think there's some secular trends, which is there is just so much capital looking for return. There are not many places you can get it now. So I think there's going to be a trend overall to continued growth while it's going to continue to be cyclical. So I think, you know, one thing when you think about access to capital for companies that are private, it's there. that's a nice thing. There's additional supply, and it isn't always through simply the traditional sort of venture investors. Secondarily, the nature of the public markets have changed. There's shorter term kind of thinking, you know, in the last couple of decades, in particular the last decade, the advent of high frequency trading has really changed the nature of investment holdings, the requirements and the cost of going public. We certainly will talk about the Jobs Act later, but we did a lot of work to make it more affordable and accessible for small companies to go public, but it's still a very expensive proposition. The disclosure means that as a high growth company, I need to share with my competitor all my secret sauce. So there are lots of other reasons to stay private. And in addition to that short-term versus long-term orientation, I think probably when you talk to entrepreneurs, I think it's that short versus long-term orientation. They go from sitting at a table with me, and I'm thinking in terms of decades, to somebody who's thinking, at best case, a quarter, and high-frequency mm-hmm. trading per day. Mm-hmm. So I want to have long-term growth. How do I round out these two? So we kind of, there have been, I think JP Morgan may get credit for this. I think they called it debt product they had, SPL, Stay Private Longer. at least we'll give them on the podcast credit. I think about the SPL domain. What are different ways that companies can think about Stay Private Longer, or at least begin to have maybe a pathway to going public? And we'll hold Jobs Act back for a while and talk about things like secondary markets. You know, if I'm saying to a company, and we were investors in Exact Target that went public, actually the day the Jobs Act was passed, March 2012, excuse me. One of the things when they were private, we said to the company, we think the best thing is to stay private and invest aggressively in growth. They went from being the same size as their competitor to twice the size, and they went public five times the market cap. The public markets reward the dominant, provider in the market. The winner takes all, it certainly gets outsized rewards. And so we thought it was, and particularly as a recurring revenue company, if we invested privately, the public markets might not like that we were getting increasingly unprofitable, but they were building a highly accretive recurring revenue model. But what we did with the management team at the time, Scott Dorsey was the CEO, we said, look at, why don't we, typically you think, gosh, if I'm buying shares in a company and the management team is selling, is there a problem? Do they know something I don't know? Mm-hmm. And certainly when Mark Pinkus sold at the kind of the peak of Zynga's market cap, $12, it's still eking its way up from its lows below 5 to 8 now. You'd say, Martin maybe do better than public investors. But in this case, I think Exact Target and Scott had a point. We're going to ask the management team to run a marathon. They've been killing themselves. They're getting under market pay and they're get equity. This is a way to not liquidate them entirely, but let's take 5-10% of the equity, options from the management team, allow them to replenish the, college savings for their kids, maybe pay down the mortgage. It wasn't making, they weren't buying islands with it. And that allowed them to say, go home to their families and say, I'm still going to work till late at night at the job, at the company, because we're going to have the chance to go public and really create a great company. And they went public in the case of Exact Target and then sold the Salesforce for $3.6 billion, providing lots of capital that now is being played on through those founders to startups in Indianapolis, which is pretty darn exciting. So I think that idea of secondaries being used in particular to allow founder teams to find outlets for their shares while still remaining aligned with the new investors. They're still saying primarily invested. So secondary markets are one way. And by the way, the other side, you have lots of investors that range from mom and pops to even investors like T. Rowe and Fidelity and BlackRock that want to get that high growth that's happening while a company is still private in their mm-hmm. portfolio. They have been buyers as along with others of those secondary shares. And that's expanded into the what's now third-party tender offers, where the company really sponsors that kind of offering. You don't just have it trading on an off exchange. It's really organized and sponsored by the company. The company might even buy back the shares itself, putting it maybe, getting its ownership level sort of back under control in certain ways. So there are lots of aspects we have. Certainly, you have folks like the SoftBanks of the world that may be retreating slightly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. At a market like today, you see their experience with WAG and WeWork and others. They may be retreating, but I think some of these vehicles are going to stay in play, and I think are healthy. I think in most markets, having liquidity is a healthy thing, keeps people honest and straight up. And as long as they're still somewhat aligned, I think it makes sense. And there have also been things that have happened in the public markets. We can talk about, you know, SPACs and direct listings and mm-hmm. dual.
So maybe
that's the whole public side of things, is just a slightly different realm.
Yeah. So let's remain for a while in the private side. You know, I know you played a very important role in the Jobs Act, and you were involved in the discussions in Congress on the IPO ramp side. And you know, let's talk about that, because it's interesting to have you share some of your experience. You know, one of the questions I've had is, one of the things that happened in Jobs Act was that they extended the rule of having 500 shareholders to list to 2,000, which was kind of inverse of getting IPOs, and it was allowing companies to stay private for longer. Can you share, what happened there? And I know there was congressional, it was part of the negotiation, but maybe you can give us a bit more light onto that process.
Well, you're being very polite on this podcast, as I was helping sort of advocate, certainly with institutional investors who we care a lot about, we're continuing to have protection in this bill that was passed, and legislators and regulators. We spent time with the SEC. You're being polite, saying, explain this to me. Some people were saying, what were you thinking? Why were all these things that seem to be contradictory put in one bill? And the truth of the matter is, there were five separate bills, and actually, this dates back to March 2011. When you go back and think about what was happening then, it was post the 08 recession. We had spent a lot of time thinking about fixing the public markets, the credit markets, the debt markets. There were, all the attention that was being paid there. And we were really trying to figure out, how do we get, more solidly on the road to recovery, not just for large companies, but for small companies. Mm-hmm. And the administration, policymakers on both sides of the aisle were really trying to figure out, what can we do for small companies? We know, half the companies and half the employees in the country work for small businesses. We know that now in COVID time, and we're talking a lot about that. And so there was an event that was held at Treasury. Tim Geithner was the treasurer, Treasury Secretary at the time, and it was a little symposium in the cash room at the Treasury, and it was all about access to capital for small companies. And there were debt providers there. Silicon Valley Bank was there. There were public and private folks talking, public market, private market exchanges. Everybody was at the table. And the group that I was associated with wrote what became Section 1 of 7 of the Jobs Act, the IPO on-ramp. Gets a lot of press because people read about companies going public, but it was really a compilation of five different bills. And mm-hmm. some of them were about crowdfunding. Bill Hambrecht, a very well-known supporter of company startups, supported something around Reg A. That was one of the bills. We had general solicitation, which allowed accredited investors to be more active in private markets. And then we had what you're referring to, which is mm-hmm. 500 shareholder rule. Mm-hmm. And at the time, the company we all know a lot about ourselves, Facebook, was mm-hmm. still private. And because they were growing so much privately, they had no problem getting access to capital as a private company. They were beginning to hit up against what was called the 500 shareholder rule, mm-hmm. which came out of the SEC that said, once you have more than 500 shareholders, we think you are big enough that you should start disclosing all of your financials. So all of a sudden,
the same rule that Google hit up and had to go public in 2004.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And exactly. And everyone was saying, well, gosh, if we want to allow Facebook to stay private, they're growing. There was reticence, as we talked about, for many entrepreneurs, including Mark Zuckerberg, who later said it wasn't as bad as he thought, but at the time he was interested in staying private. And so it was on everyone's mind that, gosh, why don't we expand that to be 2,500? So it allowed them to stay private longer. So then going back to, Kate, what's your answer? Why did all this get combined? Again, we were interested in providing, and I was, I think all of us were supportive, providing as many tools as possible for, and I still believe this, for a company to have in accessing capital over the growth of its life. And that may be capital that allows them to stay private longer, not go public, to take accredited investors who are, you know, mom and pops coming through crowdfunded sources, and that's grown over time. There's nothing wrong with giving entrepreneurs more tools for success. And frankly, to have people like venture capitalists be competitive. If I compete with other sources of capital for the company, I have to continue to prove my worth. It's not only what I'm getting out of it from a venture return point of view. Am I being a good, you know, is it worth having a venture investor as an investor? I think having more sources is absolutely fine. And so that's how all those things came together. So it's literally a patchwork of five bills. I actually have a little slide, which at some point I can share with you. We can see each other. We can't, unfortunately, our podcasters can't hear it, but it actually is a little history of the background of each of them. And it was the House of Representatives that actually combined it together and came up with the name Jobs Act.
Maybe I'll just add it in the show notes, and I can link it out.
I'll send it to you. Okay. It's actually really nicely done. And it showed that some of these, and it's nice because showed that some of these tools are really helpful when you're a very early stage company. And then as you become more mature, you use different aspects of the Jobs Act. So that's how this illogical thing came to being. There was a...
I love this story because it's important to get kind of the clarity of what happened and why do we have the rules that we have. You know, we've talked about long-term and short-term, and I'm sure you get this. I certainly get this, where we have directors that have different horizons in terms of how they think about valuing or the value of the companies. And in some level, in public companies, the discourse of governance has been very drawn by institutional investors or proxy advisors who have a certain view of what good governance looks like. And then when you come to Silicon Valley, there's a different view, which is, well, the decisions should be made by the entrepreneurs who have the vision, who think long-term. And when we've had these companies go public many times with dual class shares, there is this ideological debate, which is very strong. And I've talked a lot about in my podcast, by the way. I'm not obsessed about this theme, but I think it's very interesting because it's a very corporate governance theme. And, you know, what do you think about this? I mean, you've dabbled in both worlds. So you also have kind of the understanding of what institutional investors want to see in terms of good governance. And on the other end, you have, you know, the vision of what entrepreneurs or private investors want to see. You know, I remember years ago, Marc Andreessen said something like, there's never been more patience for private companies and less patience for public companies, right?
Yes.
And basically, it's an interesting way to think about it. What is your experience in this domain? And let me just say one little thing about this. Dual class shares get a lot of press, but it's typically reserved for the very high-end companies. So it's the big companies. It's Facebook, it's Google, it's like the big ones, but not typically
the unicorns.
For every startups. Right.
And decacorns, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, but it hits at an issue that is out there, and I think Mark was spot on when he made that comment. And we should quickly make sure. I'm sure most of your listeners get it, but dual class meaning you may sell, you know, a Series A or B, whatever you decide to number it, certain shares that have more voting rights than other shares, and the objective is that the investors or the investing family or whoever wants to maintain control and really be able to continue to invest in the company. Interestingly, by the way, we think of it as a Silicon Valley phenomenon, but Ford has 40% of their shares dual listed. And I think it's great because it kind of makes us all realize that this is a consistent, and it's now the Ford family who continues to control those shares. Berkshire Hathaway has dual class shares similarly. So it's actually, it was sort of Silicon Valley, you know, taking a page out of the books that were out there. I will call out a successful example of, because really what, let me back up. Why is that then when you think about Silicon Valley? These startups have gone, you know, from thinking about massively investing in growth. And perhaps, as we see as a debate constantly with IPOs, gosh, you're still losing money and you're going public. But gosh, I want growth. Can't I get profitability and growth? Well, no, you need to invest in growth. And the pace of change and the rate of change, when you look at, by the way, top 10 publicly listed companies, six of them are tech companies, from Alibaba to Microsoft to Facebook. They represent 80% of the value. And the average lifespan of a company on the public markets has gone from 33, actually it was 50, I guess, in the 1950s. In the 1960s, it was 33. It's less than 20 now. It's projected to go down towards 10 in the next 10 years. So the cycle of change with, large public companies getting, disintermediated by startups is happening. And so if I'm an entrepreneur and I'm thinking, I need to invest in change, I know that being a disruptor, I'm going to be rewarded by it. I'm going to be a market leader. I'm going to capture more growth, I'm going to capture more market share. Then going public and having the short termism where I've got somebody who benefits from my failure, by the way, a short seller, and who's going to measure me at the maximum on my quarterly goals and measurements seems completely antithetical. That's what gave rise to entrepreneurs wanting protection from those investors by having dual class shares. The best protection is having a good investor relations. And that really comes down, for the most part, to leadership, having direct communication with investors. My poster child for that is Amazon. Jeff Bezos, as a leader, reading his conversations, and I encourage anybody who's interested in governance and conversation to read his shareholder letters over time, as a conversation with leadership to the shareholders about what they're doing with the profits, which is a combination of investing in growth by buying companies and investing technology and reducing the price of their services or products like they are on AWS in order to get market leadership. I mean, he has thrown the entire innovation book out there. And by the way, he doesn't have dual class shares and it's worked. That's rare. I think even with or without dual class shares, I think that's increasingly something all shareholders and all leadership teams and all boards should be having increasing conversations of how do we invest in growth. I think if we're not, look over your shoulder. So that's what got us to this question of dual class shares. It did start with Google, Facebook, Snap. Institutional investors, I think, have been, and understandably, significantly concerned. I think it's interesting. There was a Harvard Wharton study that showed that having heavy ownership in the hands of the management team was a great aligned with performance. And they actually showed in the study that having voting control concentrated in the founders did not. Now, I think that's a story that's still being written. We'll see. Most of the programs, whether dual class shares, they burn off over time, either when the ownership goes down. That was the case in our portfolio with a company that had been in our portfolio box. Founders came to have ultimately less than 5% ownership. So the dual class shares expired, sometimes expires over time. Some cases, as with Snap, it never does. And it's very difficult because institutional investors, again, working on the Jobs Act, the one question I had with institutional investors was, what's your biggest concern? Because we were very concerned to make sure they were comfortable from an investor protection point of view. And their biggest concern, of course, is that that's covered, but their number one concern was finding growth. So in many ways, they've had to hold their nose and are buying into them because you can't not own these high growth companies in your portfolio. But to your point at the start, it is not, certainly as extends and now dual class shares have extended into the private markets, it is not common for most private companies to have them. And even most public companies don't have them, or if they do, they're very temperate and considered a transition to fully liquid, common and equivalent ownership of shares going forward. But it's interesting, one of the things you and I talked about in preparing for this was a different take at coming at this, which is something that Eric Ries, who wrote the Lean Startup and is quite known as a speaker, and I think kind of and those that are interested in kind of the power of innovation, not just for startups, for public companies, should really be a student of a lot of his writings. And he's done a lot of work as an example with Fortive that's doing a lot of growth and innovation work. He's been a really incredible, thought-provoking participant in some of our conversations there about how we innovate. One of the things he's done is to start something. I think Mark Andreessen is an example as an investor. He started something at a venture exchange called the long, it's LTSE. It's really the long-term
stock exchange.
Yeah. And it's going to be interesting to see how that goes. They've been approved by the SEC last year. They have yet, as I understand it, to launch any listings. But it's really intended to be a place that encourages this kind of long-term thinking, where the longer I, as a public owner, so it's now not as much focused on dual-class shares in the founders, but if I am investing in that exchange, the longer I hold the shares, the more voting power I will get. So it puts more control in the and incents me to hold it for a longer period of time. The management team is less bound by short term guidance on growth, where I can use more vehicles that incent long term CEO long term goals for the CEO in terms of compensation. Right now, institutional investors and proxy advisors aren't as thrilled by that. CII, the Council of Institutional Investors, has not been as thrilled. We'll see how that works. I think when we go back to this and when we think about this continuum, to your point, we have long-termism on the private side and incredible short-termism on the public side. All of this is a way to find, and what we were trying to do with the Jobs Act, is can we find a continuum? Because it's not just the entrepreneurs that are trying to go from a 10-year to a 10-minute perspective what I'm investing in. The investors too want to invest in growth. So I think we're, all of this, and I think it's something that's going to be played out over time. What is the right place for us? Where is the middle ground? And these are all different kinds of experiments to find that, while still providing the right governance for all the parties involved. It's an interesting, we're going to see this play out, and I bet in 2 years, 5 years, maybe even in a year, we'll continue to innovate.
No, I think it's a great experiment. I mean, it goes into the root problem of long-termism and how to think about it. So I'm also looking at the long-term stock exchange as something that provides a solution that at some level dual-class shares tries to resolve, but there are tensions from different parties. And one aspect that I think is interesting in this debate is, in this continuum, right, you have a startup, as you said, you're an investor, you got an entrepreneur, you're two people in the boardroom, then you do maybe a Series B, Series C, you start adding those investors, maybe you start adding independent directors. One aspect of all of this is that as these companies have grown, we've seen this new class of unicorns where the companies valued, decacorns or more, right? $20, $50, $60, $70 billion, where essentially they have a governance framework of a very small startup. It typically maybe just the founders, maybe the few investors. And we've seen some corporate governance scandals, right? Uber, we've seen Theranos, we've seen Zenefit, SoFi. Now WeWork is the big example of this. And I think this is where there's most tension, because we have a very clear framework of what a governance and public companies exist. We have a good framework in private venture back, but there's suddenly this new category of company and there's tension. And it's interesting to think about it in these terms. And I think it's evolved a little bit, right? Now you've seen all these companies that are adding more women to their boards. In diversity is getting, more play, thoughtful in that level, more independent directors. It's not clear that there is a push, by the way, from Delaware courts where many of these cases have been litigated. And so it's interesting in this evolution. Do you have something about these unicorns that make you think on the governance side and how to think about them in a different way, or should they just be regulated the same way? I mean, anything has come up in your radar?
Well, this is definitely a hot topic, and I think a lot of people have seen all this play out, and I think governance is an issue. And I mentioned earlier that the markets that I live in are highly cyclical. The last decade, there's been a huge amount of founder influence and control. So take Uber as an example. Bill Gurley, a very practiced investor, very successful. There was and I wasn't in that boardroom, so I won't speak to that. But he has a long history of good governance. But this was a situation where Travis Kalanick had a huge amount of actual control, even as a private company, his ability to appoint, you know, have a board seat and all these other kinds of things at a time when he has a whole lot of power, not really listening to his board and having a real sense of governance. And you see what happens. You also have companies like WeWork and Theranos, where frankly, you don't have a lot of people that had understood and come out. There weren't venture investors in WeWork. When you look at Theranos, you had venture investors there who often, most of them were not on the board, who actually weren't biotech investors. And a lot of the board were people who were very experienced and successful in other fields. And there was a huge amount of founder awe. Well, that allowed for some of the, you know, and there is a benefit in a venture-backed startup. I'm worrying about the pensioner who I need to give returns for. I am all over what's happening in that company, or I'm in trouble. Right. And I think it, when you end up with these large private companies, I think you absolutely do have an issue and something that's gotten an awful lot of attention. But guess what? As markets start to feel their peak, those are the first kinds of investors to go away. As companies stay private, that, you know, we are, by the way, there are still SEC rules that govern private companies, sure. As you know, better yep. than I do. But how those things play out, I think will be very interesting. And there is more of a focus on the part of certainly the public investors that invest through venture capital and private equity to look through to our companies to understand governance. And mm-hmm. it includes diversity, which you can talk about in a second. But I think broadly, they're being really mindful about making sure that their capital is being well, taken care of. Again, when you look at a lot of these companies, that, you know, their sources of capital came from places that might not have been as focused, at least during that peak of the market, on those kinds of issues. But they're big wake-up calls to that. And I going into the diversity, equity, and inclusion piece of it, you know, that's a good example where in the public side, public investors, there's a lot of transparency and accountability across the board for good behavior, good governance, good leadership, a check and balance where there is and by the way, I love being on public boards, that view that and it's true with private boards too, but you see it very much in a public board. Any question is a good and thoughtful question. Management mm-hmm. takes it seriously. They should. Mm-hmm. Because the accountability and transparency that's required in the public markets, that happens. Again, that's now, and that's extended to public investors pushing for ESG. Are you being a good shepherd on behalf of all constituents, the environment, your community, and mm-hmm. us? Are you being good to your employees? Do you have a diverse and inclusive, safe environment? That's now pushing into the private side. Because more companies are staying private, whether it's in venture or private equity hands, the amount of capital that is private has really grown. And the amount of capital and the number of companies and public exchanges has shrunk over time. So mm-hmm. it is a really interesting time where, again, sort of through a group called Institutional Limited Partners Association, folks can look it up, ILPA.org, they have been increasingly thoughtful and engaged with their members in being sure that private companies are mindful of all the governance issues that they want to see implemented, ESG in a broad sense, specifically things over the last year and a half around diversity and inclusion. While harassment is not the same as inclusion, it's a neighbor, and it's a kind of risk, certainly in the high risk, high reward continuum that I invest in. That's not risk they're underwriting. They're underwriting, does the technology work and will somebody buy it? They're not underwriting whether the CEO is harassing their employees. And that's the kind of thing that certainly our institutional investors are taking a much bigger role in. And frankly, industry groups like the NVCA, the National Venture Capital Association, that I've been on the board of a couple of times. I'm now on the board of an affiliate of theirs. That's a foundation that's really focused on inclusion and geographic, gender, race, all versions of diversity we can think of, and bringing that, being mindful of that, and bringing that in as best practices into the venture community, both our firms and our portfolio companies, and giving us the kind of tools we need that have been practiced and tools that have been available in public companies over time. So you're right. This stay private longer market has engendered all kinds of issues of governance. But again, you know, it's often the same institutional investors that are the ultimate source of capital around the table. And they're speaking up, and they should. They have every right to.
You know, one thing that I explained that I think, you know, makes a structural difference, right? If you think about composition of public boards, you have a requirement from the New York Stock Exchange, from NASDAQ, to have a majority of independent directors. And if you look at the recruitment of new directors, there is a big change in the number of diverse candidates. In fact, California has a new law, right, which requires California corporations. So we've seen big numbers of recruitment. It's gone from 20% to 30%, right, of directors that are women and boards. Whereas in private boards, what happens in venture-backed companies is we don't have the same level of independent directors. So who are the directors? You got to be the founders or the investors. And to the extent that you don't have founders or investors that are diverse, there is this deeper or structural problem in diversity. So it's really good to see these new initiatives that you've, you know, led in NVCA and other groups, and particularly with the LPs, to kind of shift and how can you do it in a different fashion to improve the condition of private startups in terms of diversity and inclusion.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, you know, there are a number of different, you know, there are a lot of tools now we can bring to bear, let me say, because I agree with you. On public boards, I've had some recruiters, and these are the top line recruiters, say that 80% of the board fills they're doing are for diverse candidates. And you're right. We were thrilled to see the California bill pass on one level. As a female, I regret that it didn't extend to diverse board candidates. I think that's a missed opportunity because I think it doesn't stop. And in fact, on the venture side of things, while women are minority at leadership levels of venture firms and startups, when it comes to race, leadership representation rounds to zero. So women have it pretty good if we're 10% of the venture industry. So I think there's, you know, both, we need to solve diversity in its broadest sense. But there are a lot of good tools that are starting to be used. The Rock Center at Stanford that you had been part of has done a lot of work around training folks. The NVCA is giving tools to help people. How do I think about the best practices? And we have a term sheet on the NVCA site where I do two things. One, we have agreement when I put in the term sheet that there is no harassment of me, of anybody, and or anybody on my team and with the startup and vice versa. And when I sit on the board, one of the things what happens in a startup is you are massively growing. This is why it's good for the US economy. You're creating jobs. You go from two people to hundreds, you know, to thousands, as we've talked about with the shareholder rule. And, you know, with that, you want to be sure that you're building a team from day one. Aaron Levy, the CEO of Box, on an interview he had on was early on in their public life, said he was watching what was happening to big public companies like Google and Facebook and Microsoft and said, gosh, I don't want to have to remodel my locker room later. Maybe I should be mindful of diversity and inclusion from the day I founded the company. But we're trying to give folks like Aaron or their board members, the kinds of tools so that they can figure, think about how to go public. So NVCA is doing a lot of that work. Him for Her is something that's been founded, and a lot of the luminaries in the industry are really helping think about on their public boards how to find more women and diverse leaders to join their board. So there's been a lot of outreach. I think there's a lot of work to be done, and encourage folks who are interested in boards to raise your hand, put your resume up on Board List or Boardspan, or look at Him for Her and Stanford Women on Boards. There are lots of different, increasingly ways to get your name out there. And I think on the private side, we need to find folks like that because there's some great leaders out there who should be adding as independent directors. I think their skill set, regardless of their diverse, what they represent, but it's valuable to represent the population that is working in the firms, who are going to be buying the technology, using the technology, all the logical reasons that inclusion is a very good thing.
All right. Well, this has been great. I mean, I think we've covered a lot of ground in startups and public boards. Maybe we're going to switch gears now and go through some rapid fire questions, which is to get to know you more personally and not so much about the governance. So first question is, what are the 1 to 3 books that have greatly influenced your life?
You know, that's an easy one. I think my favorite book remains The Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens, for so many reasons. and I won't bore you with all of them, but it was actually the first book that got me. So it was, first I thought, I'm reading, old book, it's long. I got so engaged. It was the best, most riveting story. It had drama, intrigue, the villainous woman, Madame Defarge, knitting away who was going to next die on the guillotine. It had all the intrigue. So it drew me in as a piece of literature. But it plays into themes that I still find playing out in my life. And, a big focus on social justice, the themes of income inequality, what was going on, why was there an issue, the throne in France was, living high while the people were living in the streets, this whole issue of income inequality that we're living out today. It had messages of hope, though, redemption, resurrection. I am a big fan of Tale of Two Cities. Okay. And that's played itself out in so many ways forward. So that's an easy one for me.
Okay. So that is the one book or you have more?
That's my book. I mean, I thought about three. But there's so many aspects. And it's, by the way, and I think about what I do, I'm a nonprofit, so talk about income inequality. It's all about getting engaged. What was the French Revolution about? Call to arms. If you want to do something, make it happen. Third, you can have fun and learn in the process. And I like politics and policy and all that sort of, the roots of the American Revolution were born in the French Revolution. There were lots of reasons. It's my one, two, and three.
Okay. We'll add it in the show notes, and I'm sure some people will take it up. Second question is, who were your mentors and what did you learn from them this is a good question to understand. And I think mentorship is an important element of people's careers.
Well, this is one of my favorite topics. I actually taught a class at Stanford in ESL class. It was eCorner. It's out of the mm-hmm. engineering school. It's about entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. And it's an hour long class and it's spliced up into small pieces. And the piece that got the most replay is something that I referred to there. And I always thought of as having composite mentors. Mm-hmm. It is hard to go up to somebody as a junior person and say, "Will you be my mentor?" We're all so busy. And I think I have a dozen plus mentees, including mm-hmm. a woman in Ramallah in Palestine, which is very cool. A formal mentor, but you only have limited bandwidth and it's an awkward thing, right? I actually, through my career, I had a composite source of mentors because not everybody's good at everything. That's mm-hmm. the point of getting advice. And that, by the way, the value of diversity. So I sort of had this composite. I didn't even ask somebody, "Will you be my mentor?" Mm-hmm. What I did was say, "Can I go out to lunch?" And I would trust the person. I would know them. I knew they would give me good advice. And I often was looking for somebody who either had more experience than I did and might have perspective on my growth and who I felt who would give me honest feedback. Your best friend is the one who tells you if it's spinach in your teeth, right? Mm-hmm. But also people, I think of composite mentors that can be 360s in that it might be a peer. My partner, Sharon Weinbar, I come at the world as she was an engineer undergraduate, but her professional career, she worked in marketing in tech companies. She's taught me everything I know about marketing. She might be surprised in listening to this that I consider her, I think she would get it when she hears this, as a mentor. And she taught me everything I know about marketing. So I would go out to lunch with her and say, how did you do this? How would you solve that? What would you think about that? I come at science and math and computer science as my second language. And so learning from somebody. So I had this composite group of people. And by the way, it doesn't have to be somebody you even No, it might be somebody you observe in the public and you think about their speaking style. You observe them, you listen. And I think therefore, your question then, so what are my mentors? I had many. I gained them all the time. And the learnings I have, and when I think about particularly the senior people, the successful people I've followed that I've known and those I've admired from afar, it's that you have to be devoted to continuous improvement. That you always are thinking about how you can grow and be better and improve. One of my mentors was one of the founders of Greylock. And I remember my co-founder and I went into him green, wet behind the ears. And we sat in front of Dave's desk and we said, "So Dave," squiggling in our little chairs, "when do we know if we're getting good at this business?" And he leaned back in his chair and he came back and said, "Well, it must be 26 years because I've been doing this for 25. And what a great way of thinking. Mm. So that's what I've learned from my mentors.
All right, that's great. You know, one question that gets some, I wouldn't say pushback, but I think it's tough, is that, are there any quotes that you think of often or you live your life by?
You know, that actually is an easier question for me. It was when I was a senior in high school, my history professor was very provocative. He pushed me a lot. I was a good student. And I was sort of used to being an A student. I'd never really been challenged as I was by him. And I remember once kind of going to him thinking, you know, I'm used to getting A's. What are you doing here? He was a Harvard grad and relatively young. And the message he gave to me, he quoted Winston Churchill and said, "Kite flies highest against the wind, not with it." And I've translated that into some classes. I did a community TEDx talk, where particularly in speaking to women and minorities and folks getting into an industry and learning to take more risk. Another way of thinking of it is failure is feedback. That I was used to, gosh, it's only good to get A's. No, sometimes having some failure and having the wind at you might teach you even more. You're going to iterate like a startup to your success. So for me, that's one I continue to live by. Kites rise high. So every once in a while when it feels pretty windy, I think, well, I must be learning a lot right now. If it doesn't kill me, it'll make me stronger.
Okay, I like it. And what is an unusual habit or an absurd thing that you love?
Okay. Absurd thing that I love. And luckily we don't have videotapes because I don't think I'm very good at it, but my husband and I just love turning on any music. We are not, we just love music and we dance in the kitchen and we think nice. We are great. Now, if there was a video on us, I'm not sure that would hold up in the court of public opinion. But if there's
nobody's watching, right? The classic saying, dance like nobody's watching. So that's great.
That's exactly what I do. That's exactly what I do.
Okay. And finally, you know, is there any living person that you most admire?
You bet. And it all comes back to the law. Mm-hmm. Notorious RBG. I'm a huge fan of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And for your listeners, that's less a political comment. I share her politics. Mm-hmm. But I think you think about, and having, again, been a bit of a student of hers, how she's continued, again, talk about rising against adversity. Every time you might have counted her out, she kept moving forward. She's continued to have opportunity and reinvent herself throughout her life. I mean, look at what she's doing now. And by the way, I do her workout. I mean, come on. But I'm learning from
it's amazing, RBG. Right?
If she can do push-ups every day, I should do push-ups every day. So Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Supreme Court Justice, otherwise known as Notorious RBG, and I love her sense of humor, keeping that and her stylish look. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on. She's the full package. So I'll give it to Notorious RBG.
All right. Well, that's great. Kate, it's been excellent to talk to you. Every time we have a conversation, I'm energized. You know, your views on governance and in life in general is great. So hopefully, you know, we'll stay connected. I'm sure we'll talk more soon. And thank you for taking the time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I always enjoy it, Evan. Again, you give when you get back. And I always, you know, the focus on governance is one that I'm glad you're calling attention to it. Everybody wins with
right.
governance. So thanks for bringing it up. And I look forward to the next time we connect.
All right. Thank you very much. Bye,
Take
everyone.
Care. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. If you like what you heard, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast with your friends or colleagues. If you'd like to reach out to me, you can find me on LinkedIn or Twitter at Evan Epstein. You can also check out all the details related to this podcast at www.boardroom-governance.com.